Thursday afternoon. Thanks very much for joining us. Bennett Wicknight is the producer today, as always. And Elise Glink will be here in the second half hour. You know, we usually talk about economics and focus on housing. There were some more housing numbers out today and then earlier this week, again, about the fact that the supply, the number of homes on the market are low, and that's keeping home sales low. The ones that do go up for sale aren't lasting very long, but there just aren't enough there to keep the demand in check. So we'll talk to Elise about that. Also, about maybe wellness vending machines that are coming into offices too. That's in the second half hour. Bill Geiger will be here a little bit later this half hour to talk about managing for retirement, but we're going to start things off with Joyce Nestrick. She is the president of the American Association of Nurse Practitioners, and she joins us on a phone line now. Joyce, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
You bet. I want to start just in general, because I have to admit, when I saw that you were coming on, I had to figure out, I had in my mind an idea of what a nurse practitioner is. So I had to do a little research, and I'm still not sure I quite get it altogether. So if there's a pecking order, there are doctors, then NPs, and then a nurse. How does all of that work? Tell me who the nurse practitioners are.
So a nurse practitioner is a registered nurse with either a master's degree or a doctorate of nursing practice degree. And we are nurses. We come from a nursing line. We're registered nurses. And we do advanced practice roles. So we partner with our patients, and we provide acute care, chronic care services to patients. We treat and diagnose.
You could write me a you could write me a prescription if I needed it.
Absolutely.
And you have hospital privileges often.
Yes. So, and we also have acute care nurse practitioners that work in the hospitals, perhaps as a hospitalist or some other. So, about 85% of nurse practitioners work in primary care settings.
And as you oversee this group, I mean, it looks as if your numbers are booming. Is that the case?
Well, right now we have over 77,000 members of the American Association of Nurse Practitioners, and about 334,000 nurse practitioners across the U.S.
I would imagine the idea is that they greatly alleviate the crowding, wait times, and things like that.
I think that we're a very big asset to patients who need access, to health care.
And from what I look at the numbers, it's not a bad way to make a living.
Oh, absolutely. And I think nursing itself is a very rewarding profession. And definitely as a nurse practitioner, there's a lot of rewards and opportunities, particularly, with access to care in an aging population. I think it's an ideal profession to be in.
I think I'll say the numbers. I think the mean price for salary was right around $105,000. So that's pretty nice. Tell me about, here we are. I just dropped my son off at college last weekend. He's a sophomore. But I remember when we dropped him off as a freshman, one of the things, and I don't know if we've done it yet, Joyce, was to go to the health center and sign that document where they could tell me about his health condition. There are a lot of things that parents don't understand when they send their kids to college that they need to do to sort of keep up to speed.
Yeah, so certainly in some states, a college-age child is definitely, if they're over 18, is considered an adult. So you would have to sign a waiver to say that that the college health department or the school could give you information about your child's health or health condition. So it would be up to your son or daughter to decide if they want you to have that information.
And I think at his, and I'll tell him it's my information, but I think at his school, too, it's required to have health insurance, that if you don't have it through your family, you have to buy it through the school. Is that common?
So that is very common. And so oftentimes schools will oftentimes offer some lower cost packages. But even now, in the midst of the healthcare reform, and we don't really know what's going on. But during the ACA, Affordable Care Act,
sure,
offers insurance for students up to age 26. And from what we've seen so far, that's going to continue. So that would cover your children on your insurance. But if they don't have insurance under you, they're oftentimes a lower cost packages that your college or university may offer.
Let me ask you this. My daughter studied abroad last year, and it didn't even occur to me to check insurance to see what was covered, if she was covered, or things like that. Was that a mistake to assume that she just would have been covered under our plan here in the States?
Yes. You definitely need to check ahead of time. I did the same thing when my daughter studied abroad, and fortunately there wasn't any incidents that occurred. But you really need to look at your insurance policy, make sure that there's no restrictions on study abroad, know what will happen, what kind of medications you can bring into the country. If there's vaccination requirements, those might not be covered by your insurance plan. And the U.S. Department of State usually has a checklist for your health while you're abroad, so you might want to access that to see if there's any information on there you're missing. So check the terms and conditions of your policy, and oftentimes there may also be a plan that you can buy in addition, so you want to check more about that.
That's Joyce Nestrick.
There's also a site at healthcare.gov on student health that might be helpful for parents.
Joyce Nestrick, the president of the American Association of Nurse Practitioners. Nice to talk to you today. I appreciate the information. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much.
Bill Geiger from Geiger Wealth Management is in the studio. Our regular conversations with Bill are sponsored by Geiger Wealth Management. I would say welcome back, but I just saw you about 12 hours ago.
That's right.
What a surprise. I'm at the Cub game last night, and here's someone standing in front of me, and I'm about to say, sit down so I can watch the game, and it's Bill Geiger.
What a surprise. Out of 41,000 people were in the same.
We literally were sitting one behind the other. It was amazing.
Yeah.
And I suppose if we could score 17 runs every game, the Cubs would be okay.
I think they'd probably go a long way.
What an exciting game that was.
That was fun.
And so how do we make the transition from that to retirement planning?
Well, I'll tell you, I was thinking about this on the way to the studio today. How much more fun was it when the Cubs were 5 or 8 points ahead?
Right, a lot.
You could sit back and you could relax and you could enjoy the game. That's kind of like retirement. And the thing that makes the world go round in retirement, we're talking off air, is about income. If you've got more income coming in each month than what you need, it's like being 8 points ahead on a ball game.
Right.
You can relax.
Got a nice little cushion, and you know there's more coming.
Yeah,
you know Ian coming. Happ is going to bat in the next inning, and you're going to be fine.
Yeah, and you sit back and just enjoy it. You go to sleep at night, you're good. Income is kind of like the Holy Grail.
So how do you figure out, when you go from full out saving for retirement to starting to create income for retirement?
Well, if you're in your late 50s, to early 60s, that's the ideal time to start that transition. You want to move from pure growth, which is great but can also get you in trouble,
right?
To moving a part of your portfolio into creating dependable, sustainable income. We had a couple come in, a 60-year-old couple. I had a $1.4 million portfolio. 800,000 of it was in their 401k. It's between the two of them. They're 60 years old. We moved that 401k money into an income strategy. And by the time they retire, between Social Security and this income strategy, they'll have $130,000 a year for the rest of their life. Think about that. If you've got $130,000, you can relax and enjoy the rest of the game.
Yeah, that's not too bad.
That's not too bad.
And that's using your existing 401k to create that.
Yeah. It's got to be someplace until you retire. Why not have it someplace that time can be in your favor and create that kind of an income?
Is that the sort of thing you can do while you're still contributing to your 401k?
Oh, sure. Yeah, if you're 59 and a half or older, a lot of people don't know this, you can roll your 401k plan into an IRA and still continue to work, still continue to contribute and participate. But once you get in that IRA, you can do things like these retirement income strategies that we're talking about.
You know, I would imagine, and this is the sort of thing where you need to just get the information, right? Get the plan in place because, I think a lot, like I probably would be always chasing the higher figure. I don't want to create income right now. I want to keep growing that growth as fast as I can.
I was sitting down with a couple yesterday, and at the end of our first meeting, the gentleman said to me, he says, Bill, this is exactly what we want to do. We just don't know how to do it.
Right.
And that's what we do. We help people plan for their retirement, late 50s, early 60s, and then we help them implement that plan. And so many people are walking around just not knowing, you know, what am I supposed to be doing at this stage of my life?
Well, you know, because I think if those of us who don't know, we think that there's not a defined answer, right? But
yeah.
But is there a defined answer? I mean,
yeah.
Can you sit down and say A plus B and here you're at C and it's time?
Yeah, we can. We can. There's two big things your portfolio has got to do for you in retirement. One is produce dependable, sustainable income that you can use to supplement your Social Security. That's one thing. The other thing is you still need growth on another part of your portfolio, but it should be different than a 30-year-old's. It should be protective. It should first make sure that you don't have any big losses. Steve, in light of what we're talking about, let's do something special for our audience today. The first five callers who call in, we're going to sit down with them on a complimentary basis and show them how to put together a full-blown retirement plan that they can depend upon for the rest of their life.
All right, we'll do that. And, well, the Braves are in town tonight. Will I see you at the game tonight?
I would love to.
All right, good. Get two tickets and I'll go.
Okay, good.
Bill, great to see you again. Ian Schur is on a phone line, one of the editors at CNET.com, and he joins us from time to time. Ian, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm well, and I want you to explain. I'm all about cracking down on fake news and getting rid of it, even if it comes from, well, from whomever it comes from. But one of the things, and we started talking about this before the election, long before, the spreading of this fake news. I remember a story of some guys in Macedonia who were making money by making stories up and getting all sorts of shares and likes and things like that. And, yep. You know, Facebook is, it's a problem for Facebook. They've got to try to figure out a way to fix that without inhibiting free speech and dumb ideas, I guess. And so I know you guys are writing about something that they've come up with where they're limiting advertising or prohibiting ads, or I don't quite understand that. Can you explain that for me?
Sure. So what happens is, you know, let's say that I have a page, you know, Ian Schur, or I have a CNET page. And what happens is that I might share a lot of stories on it. And let's say I share a story and I want to send it to more people. You know, I want to advertise it almost, right? And there's a button called Boost. That's
yeah.
on Facebook pages where you can pay Facebook to basically turn your post into an ad. And so what Facebook is doing is just saying, okay, if you have a page and you're putting what we have determined to be false news on Facebook, we're not going to let you boost any of these things.
Okay.
We're going to stop you from being able to boost. We're going to stop you from being able to advertise. And they're basically trying to cut it off without trying to inhibit free speech. Now, it's tough because – you know, first off, they consider themselves to be this bastion of free speech and allow people to basically say whatever they want within the terms of service of their platform. But this is also the place where stuff like Pizzagate and, you know, the famous one was that the Pope had endorsed Donald Trump, which he had not, and he had to make a statement about it. All of these things originated at one point or another or were shared a lot on Facebook.
So that's interesting.
They're trying to do something to fix it.
So they're taking money out of their own pocket, right? When I read that, I thought maybe they were going to keep, you know, a pizza joint from advertising on someone's page. But this is money that would go to Facebook to boost the post.
Yeah, exactly. So if you want to think in terms of the Macedonian kids that you were bringing up earlier, basically if they had a page, they would not be able to boost and advertise those posts anymore. And so it would get to fewer and fewer people. Now, that wouldn't stop you or me or my wife or my aunt from sharing these things, right? So
right.
That still doesn't solve the problem, but it does reduce it on some level.
So if you're gullible, you're still gullible. But the point is that fewer gullible people will see it because it won't be boosted out to them.
It essentially, yes.
You're so nice. You're so afraid to judge anyone. I that's my effort every week. I try to get you to say something bad about someone. Do those boost?
Well, I'll work on it.
I swear. Now, Ian, I'm telling you, you know, I have a little travel business, too. And so I'm interested in boosting posts and doing things like that. But I have noticed in the past 2 weeks that every time I post something, I get a little notification from Facebook saying that post is doing better than most. Would I be interested in boosting and paying up a little
right.
bit? How effective is that? Does that work?
It is very effective. In fact, Facebook has, you know, if you're a large advertiser, Facebook will throw a lot of data at you to tell you how successful these things are. I mean, look, Facebook has taken a really large share of the advertising on the internet for a reason, is that they have data that backs up that this stuff gets people in the door, it gets them interested. You know, I spoke to some bubble tea guys in San Francisco. I don't know if you know about, you know, Thai bubble tea is very popular here.
No, I don't know.
And it's really good if you've never had it.
What is it?
And so it's tapioca balls in milk tea. It's really great. It's been around for decades, but it's having kind of a renaissance in San Francisco right now that's made it – some of these really ultra-high-end places have gotten really popular. And when I spoke to these guys, they said that advertising on Facebook and Instagram – made a whole bunch of difference toward getting the people's attention. They believe that it really works. And I think you have to have the right type of business to advertise on Facebook. Not everyone's business works correctly on it. But when you get it right, it really works.
But so are those advertising campaigns, are they done simply through a boost, or is there something more targeted, or do you have to step up a little bit?
It's a mix, actually. So boosting, you can target, right? So you can, you know, if you said, you know, I want to find people who have been to Thailand and like tea and all this stuff that you can filter out on Facebook, you can do that. But you also, you know, they actually are specifically choosing certain types of posts to put up. So they're choosing like really good photos of their tea or people having fun in their store and all that type of stuff. So it's a mix. You can't just boost everything and win.
Right.
You have to really be thoughtful about how you do it.
All right. So maybe you are boosting a post trying to get someone to travel to Australia. Everyone likes to go to Australia. Exactly. A lot of times when they do, they like to swim. But we think right away about the super crocodile alligator things in Australia and the sharks as well. And that might keep some people out of the water. Now, last year, 26 shark attacks in Australia, 2 fatalities. I would imagine when you consider the number of people who are swimming in Australia, that's not very much. But I wouldn't want to be number 3, right? That's a problem for them.
Right. I certainly wouldn't want to be either. And I was in Australia a couple of years ago, and I saw these signs for shark spotted stay out of the water all the time. So there's a lot of anxiety about it. So there's this really cool thing. I think it's one of the coolest things I've seen in a while. It's a drone called the Little Ripper, and it has on it artificial intelligence software that will actually distinguish. It has a camera, and it distinguishes between sharks, dolphins, rays, marine mammals, and even surfers. And it will, if it sees a shark, it has a megaphone on board as well, and it'll tell you, get out of the water. And it's just so smart to have something like this.
Wow.
So they're starting to use this in Australia. It's a super sharp idea, and hopefully it'll save some lives.
So it doesn't just send a signal to lifeguards that there's a shark. It actually, from where it is, starts yelling out to people that there could be danger.
Exactly. And I think that's the real benefit here, is that, you know, a lot of the technology out there these days is sensors that help, you know, kind of go to a central place like a lifeguard or to a whatever, to the police. And this is something that actually pretty much works on its own, right? You put it up in the air, all you have to worry about is whether it'll stay in the air, and it'll do its job otherwise, and it'll do the whole thing for you. And I think that's really great. And we have a photo on CNET of what it looks like when it sees the sharks. It's a super cool photo. It's just incredible that you can do that these days.
All right, so that'll put guys like David Hasselhoff and other lifeguards out of business, I would suppose.
Maybe so. We'll see.
While we're overseas, this is the 20th anniversary of Princess Diana's death. And, of course, she was very involved in landmines, fighting landmines in places like Angola and such. And I noticed that you guys on this anniversary took time to sort of go back to Angola and reexamine where they are. A lot of technology has changed since her death.
Yeah, so we sent a team to Angola, to the minefields there, and it's incredible. You know, this all came from wars that were going on in Angola, tons of landmines. It was one of the last things that Princess Diana was really trying to draw attention to before she died, was she actually went to Angola, and we went to the same places she walked down. We have photos of what they are before and after. But there are still 35,000 landmines that have not been disabled. And so we talked about some of the technology that's out there these days. It's fascinating. Like before technology really started getting involved, they were using old paper maps to identify where these landmine fields were, where they were, you know, just kind of what the topography was. Now they're using Google Earth. There's work on trying to come up with drones that will automatically explode the landmine.
Right.
But it's really fascinating. Still, the experts out there say that you cannot, nothing has gotten better at this point than having a person on the ground with a metal detector and digging.
That's amazing.
And it's an incredibly dangerous job.
I mean, it really is amazing if you think of it. You know, we're talking about drones flying over the ocean, identifying sharks and warning swimmers. Why they couldn't somehow develop some sort of technique of something hovering over the ground to find these mines.
It's really hard. And these mines are down in this ground. That's part of it. And the other part of it is that when these things explode, they cause a lot of damage. One of the mines that we saw while we were there, it actually jumps into the air and then spreads shrapnel. And so you can't, like, you have to be incredibly careful when you're disabling these things. Yeah. And that's why it's been so tough.
Ian, sure. And at CNET.com, right? You can see that article, also see a picture of that drone in action and all of that. Nice to talk to you. We'll do it again next week, I hope.
Absolutely.
Elise Glink is the publisher of ThinkGlink.com, the CEO of Best Money Moves, an HR app for businesses that helps employees measure their financial stress and then dial it down. Check that out at BestMoneyMoves.com. Hello, Elise Glink.
Hello, Steve Bertrand. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. You know, we're always talking about housing, and I guess it's because there's always something with housing to talk about. The pending home sales figure came out today. It was, down 0.8% from June. The fourth monthly drop in the past 5 months, and it's a broken record sort of, but we're still talking about the number of homes on the market, right?
Yeah, the number of homes in the market is certainly causing a problem, and it's very, very few homes. And now with Harvey, you know, I've been asked a number of times today what's going to happen with the housing market because of Harvey. And
right.
Houston was already a pretty hot market. But watch over the next couple of years for a redux of what happened in New Orleans, where all the people who know how to build houses and renovate houses and all the materials needed for that get sucked out of everywhere else and sent down to Harvey as that city copes with the loss of potentially 500,000 homes. We're looking at possibly 500,000 homes that will be applying for FEMA disaster relief. About 119,000 of those, this is an estimate, are covered by FEMA flood insurance or some sort of flood insurance.
And so the idea is that the resources are going to go down there to build homes, and they might not be in Plainfield.
That's right. They may not be there. And so existing homes, which are already, you know, far between, you know, a few and far between on the market, may even get a little bit more sparse as people either stay where they are or you see people relocating who can relocate from Houston to other cities where there is more available housing.
Tell me about that again, because you mentioned that a few weeks ago and I had no idea, because I kept saying, well, there must be enough houses for us. Why do we keep needing to build new ones, you know, to pave paradise and build new homes? And you said that's not actually the case.
Right. So houses actually, they die. I mean, they don't die in that they fall apart, although some do, but they become outmoded or outdated, or they get torn down and people build new houses in their place. I'm sure you've seen that, and we've seen in the North Shore and the western suburbs. But we also see adaptive reuse. And if you think about Detroit and what happened after the Great Recession, they literally, the city went in and they started bulldozing block after block of homes that were bought from residents for $600 a piece and or had gone into foreclosure to just clear out old housing stock. And so that's kind of a big example, but we also saw that in New Orleans. And I think we're going to see quite a bit of that here in Houston, because the kind of water that they're talking about, once you've had water,
right,
standing water this high for this long, and remember, it's like 100 degrees typically in the summer in Houston, it's a breeding ground for mold, and that stuff is, at some point, you just tear down the house and start again.
So what do you see? Do you see tear downs and rebuilding there, or do you see sort of an exodus from the area? Because if you're going to rebuild, you're going to have to live somewhere while they're rebuilding. And it's not like the people are building one house. They're building tens of thousands. It's going to take a while.
Yeah, it's going to take a long time for Houston to come back from this. It's clearly the worst. It'll be the most expensive disaster. They're already talking about it. Economic cost alone would be $150 to $170 billion. That's a very, very big number. And, yeah, I think we're going to see people trying to relocate at least temporarily. I mean, we still have water to a place where nobody can go back to their homes yet. We're also going to have to see, I think, FEMA trailers. And you've probably forgotten what those looked like from
right.
Katrina and Rita. But we had FEMA trailers that were delivered that people actually lived in for so people could help with the rebuilding and redevelopment of Louisiana. And so I think we're going to see some of that as well. But people can't just up and move, right? You've got some of the most wonderful hospital systems down in Houston. You've got oil and gas industry that's in Houston. You've just got the fourth largest city in America. The people aren't just going to vacate forever. So it'll be interesting to watch that rebuilding.
Will there be a transfer from single-family homes to multi-unit homes? I mean, I wonder, apartment buildings might go up more quickly and more people are going to live there or in condos or things like that.
You could certainly see, if there was time, you would see a rethinking of how Houston uses its open space and its developable space. One of the criticisms that's come out, and I use criticism very gingerly because this isn't, you know, certainly you don't want to level a criticism, but
right.
One of the reasons that Houston has been building so fast and so furiously is the lack of building regulations and requirements. So this is the Old West mentality. You know, you go out and you build and you just take over land. And so with very little in the way of developer regulations, there's been a lot of building that has been somewhat haphazard in a way. And I think there are some housing activists and some housing economists who would love to see some thought go into what, if anything, if you're going to rebuild, what, if anything, could be done to either prevent or ameliorate this kind of catastrophe in the future. It's clear that when you've had 3 500-year floods in 3 years, the last 3 years they've had 3 500-year floods in Houston, you've got to prepare for this again.
That's Elise Glink. Elise, glad to talk to you. I encourage people to check out bestmoneymoves.com. We didn't have a chance to talk about vending machines in the workplace where you can get healthy, maybe next week.
You bet.